Chapter 16. Directly ahead, between Miller and the island of Tahiti, the air shimmered. The water below went dead flat and turned a dull gray-green. The shimmering turned to wavering shadows, then wispy threads of cloud, and in less than a minute, a huge black thunderhead boiled toward him. Out of nowhere, literally out of a clear blue sky. Period, I guess. Within moments, it was a vast, wild storm. Roiling with huge thunderclouds, crackling with massive lightning and deafening thunder. And in spite of the fact that Miller's instruments told him the wind was behind the plane, the storm was charging straight at him at a speed approaching 70 miles per hour. "Damn it," he muttered, knowing exactly what it meant. They had found him. He didn't even have time to think about what that might imply before the storm was on him, all around him, tossing him like a feather through the raging currents of wind and enormous cumulonimbus clouds. Miller tried to bank around the storm, sneak out to the left, and head for the airport from the side. But the storm was either too quick or too massive. Perhaps both. In any case, it snatched at his plane and threw him straight down. He fought the controls and just barely escaped crashing into the ocean. At this level, the rain was beating down so hard, he couldn't see any more than 20 feet ahead. But because of the smashing impact of the rain, the wind was less. Miller gambled. He knew what the topography looked like ahead, and his little plane was far better equipped to deal with heavy rain than with hurricane-force winds, thunder, and lightning. He decided to fly blind, by instrument, no more than 10 feet above the highest wave crests in the ocean below him. He was still buffeted by the wind, but the rain beat down the worst of it, and it was not as severe at this low altitude as in the clouds above. He had a chance here. If the storm stayed like this, he could make it to the coast of Tahiti. After that, well, he would see. But if he could make it to the coast, he would survive, even if it meant ditching, splashing down into the shallow water off the beach, and walking in. He would survive. Then, miraculously, he was out of the storm. And he saw the beach no more than a mile ahead. The sun was shining, and people were playing on the sand, swimming in the lagoon, having the vacation of their lives, with no thunderstorm raging around them. Miller pulled back on the yoke and began to climb. If the storm had let him go, he would make the airport, make a safe landing, and preserve the artifact. He'd made it up to about 1,500 feet when the storm came back. This time, it did not tease him with wind-blown games of toss the plane. It did not slap him with rain. This time, the storm came out shooting the big guns. Crack! A bolt of lightning snarled through the air, inches from the wingtip. Miller jerked the plane away from it. Crack! Another bolt, on the other side now. Miller pulled the plane away, back to his original course. Crack! Again, on the same side as the first. Miller was being herded. The storm was pushing him wherever it wanted him to go. Just to experiment with that idea, he turned the plane left. Crack! Kablam! Definitely a bad idea. Lightning smashed into the wing, racing down the radio antenna and onto the instruments. Blue flame arced onto Miller's hands. "Ah!" he bellowed, letting go of the controls for just a moment. In that instant, the wind got under the plane's tail and pushed it into a dive. Miller grabbed the smoldering controls and tried to pull the plane out of its downward plunge. More powerful gusts of wind pounded the plane from side to side, and he could feel the fuselage twisting in ways it was not meant to do. Below him, he saw the control tower of the airport. As he watched, several bright red vehicles raced out of a hangar and headed for the spot where his plane was pointed. The rescue crew. Good to know they were on the ball. He hoped he wouldn't need to find out just how good they really were. With just a few hundred feet to go before impact, Miller began to pull out of the dive. The storm fought back, hitting him with furious crosswinds. The fuselage twisted more. He could feel it in the controls, see it in the way the wall beside him moved. He was sure something would give. It did. Just a second before he pulled out of the dive, he heard a loud twang behind him, and the plane lurched to the left. At first, he thought the rudder cable had broken, but the plane responded when he tried to straighten out and continue his climb. But behind him, he heard another twang, and now the plane lurched in the other direction. Again, he straightened out, and this time heard a ponderous sliding sound from behind. And as the lightning crackled around him in an all-out fireworks display, Miller realized what had happened. The artifact. The artifact had broken out of its tie-down. It was sliding around loose in the cargo area, and an object of that weight could crash right through the side of the plane if the craft were tossed around violently enough. And it was. As if it knew exactly what it was doing, the storm threw everything it had at Miller's plane. The huge gusts of wind tossed him up, down, left, and right. With each crazy slide, he heard the crate behind him shift, then smash into the bulkhead. It was just a matter of time before it broke through and fell to Earth. And then what? He didn't know if the artifact could be destroyed, but suppose it could be. Cook had said it was built to impose a logical order on time and space. If it was destroyed, what would happen? Nothing at all? Something unimaginable? Even Cook had been unable to guess. The plane was plunging downward again, and Miller could no longer think about the artifact. He was fighting for his life. Just before the power dive was about to take him to the control tower below, a massive updraft grabbed the plane and flung it hard and fast straight up. And as the noise shifted to its skyward point, he heard the noise he'd been dreading all along. Boom! Crunch! The artifact slid straight back to the tail section, probably the weakest area, and smashed the bulkhead. The plane was whipped by wind, and Miller fought to level off, but was again thrown straight down. Crash! And then up again. And this time, when the artifact hit the back wall, there could be no doubt. With a crushing, splintering crash, it broke through the fuselage and was falling. The plane tilted crazily, then leveled off without the weight of the artifact. The storm blew out as if somebody had turned off a switch, and Miller again had control of the plane. He turned in time to see the crate holding the artifact. It was falling straight for the center of the landing field. Any second now. Miller was holding his breath, eyes glued to the falling crate. What would happen? And though he was braced for something, nothing could possibly have prepared him for what actually occurred. The box fell toward the ground, and then it hit. The lights went out. In the dark, there was nothing. No form, no sensation, only dark and the presence of idea. And idea grew, gathered itself, and the crate hit the ground and the sky was a rusty brown. The land beneath him was the same color, and nothing lived here. Nothing could possibly live here, with the dim, dead sun hanging so low and huge in the sky, and the horribly dry, rusty air cutting at Miller's throat and lungs, choking him, and the crate hit the ground, and kabam! Miller's plane was tossed upward, outward, mingling with all the atoms that would ever be, and where the crate hit, the ground turned as bright as the sun. Enormous, hot waves of energy rippled outward, as if waves of water were racing away from a huge rock dropped into a lake. The energy waves rippled, spun through the spectrum in every possible color, gaining speed as they moved outward, until they were racing so fast they became invisible. Suddenly, lightning bolts began to rain down from the artifact. From the clear blue sky above, dozens, hundreds, thousands of bolts of sheer energy smashing into the artifact and the ground around it. Miller's hair stood straight out from his arms and legs as well as his head. The plane bucked, twisted, and went dead. Not just the engine this time, but everything. The instrument, the dash lights, everything. A huge explosion from the artifact rent the air and it was as if a veil had been whipped by wind and then split in half. Miller was staring down at the airport, but it was deserted. Weeds grew up through the tarmac and lightning smashed into the artifact and Miller was flying over a swamp. Something large lifted its head up to look at him, and then returned to feeding with no interest. With a shock, Miller recognized it. It was a brontosaurus.
But that's not.
Lightning smashed at the artifact. The Red Desert. Miller held his breath, hoping he would not be stuck here. A crowd of naked people with bluish skin and feathered crests shaped like mohawks stared up at him. He stared back, losing altitude now, and lightning smashed at the artifact. Another of the huge explosions. More shockwaves raced out, gaining speed until they vanished, and Miller was flicked through 24 realities so rapidly he couldn't even see what they were. For a heartbeat each, he raced through bright light, darkness, tremendous weight, a numbing vacuum where he fought the panic of being unable to breathe, then bright colors, loud noises as if someone was spinning a radio dial through dozens of channels without pausing. A three-dimensional, all-encompassing wave of color, sound, taste, and sensation raced across the field at Miller. He tasted lemons, rusted blueberry, the hot spark of cinnamon mixed with fire on his skin, and the sound of flutes. Time stopped as the flavor of rich earth burst on his tongue, wrapped in the sound of hundreds of great church bells and the feel of cold Vaseline on his skin.
Liquor!
The runway was coming up at him, and instinctively, without time to think, Miller steered the plane carefully into a dead stick landing, coasting to a stop in the center of the field, with weeds growing up all around him. For a very long time, he didn't move. Didn't dare to. He sat. Waited for something to happen. Waited for his heart to return to normal. For his breath to stop sounding like a dying old man wheezing and gasping for every breath. For the sweat to dry off on his palms. He waited for even one small hint at where he was and what had just happened. Nothing. And finally, when he thought he could move without exploding, he unbuckled his seatbelt and opened the door. He swung his legs out and dropped to the ground, amazed at how much it hurt. How every muscle seemed to be twanging, tight, and aching. He took a deep breath and looked around. There was no sign of the control tower. Unless that heap of rubble over there? Miller stepped toward it, far enough to see that, if it was the control tower, it had been in ruins for many years. Weeds grew up through the debris, and a small tree was perched on the slope of the ruins. He shook his head. Anyway, he was down. The storm was gone. There were no signs of more explosions or flickers. Whatever they had been. He was on the ground, in one piece, and for the moment at least, he was safe. Which is probably more than could be said about the artifact. Reluctantly, Miller started to walk in the direction where he thought the crate had crashed to the ground. But it wasn't even here? Or now, or whatever, wherever he was? Perhaps he should start saying it the way Cooks had. Here now. Was the artifact, or whatever might be left of it, here now? Clearly he was in the future. The state of the airport told him that. It wouldn't have existed at all in the past, and it had been kept up properly in the present. Somehow the artifact had launched him into the future. 100 years? 200? Impossible to say. He didn't have a clue what the artifact could do, or why. Even Cook had been uncertain about that. But reality still existed. It was all around him. A bird flitted past to the tree on the rubble mound. Insects buzzed. A breeze blew gently over his face. Whatever else might have happened, the artifact had not destroyed everything, as Cook feared it might. In fact, it was such a beautiful spring day that it was impossible to believe anything bad whatsoever had happened to reality. Here now, he reminded himself. So, maybe the artifact was perfectly all right. After all, what would it really take to harm a thing that powerful? There was no way to know. But surely it would take more than falling a few hundred feet from an airplane and getting hit by lightning. He hoped he was right. If the artifact was damaged, what had Cook said?
Time, space, shattered.
Whatever that meant, it clearly hadn't happened.
New reality or no reality,
he'd said. Well, if this was the worst of the new reality, it would be all right. But wait, hadn't there been something else? Something about a time it took before the effect took hold? He tried to remember, but when Cook told him, they'd been marching into the volcano to what he was sure was certain death. And some of the details weren't clear to him now. It had been, what, 72 hours? He thought that was right. 72 hours before it all locked into place. Miller checked his watch. Only 10 minutes since he'd landed. It seemed like coming through that last strange storm had happened in another lifetime. So, 72 hours from now, he had to be somewhere. No, before 72 hours. And Cook had given them coordinates. But what were they? 30-something, 100-something, but north or south, east or west? He didn't have a clue. Well, it didn't matter. The artifact would be fine, he was quite sure. It was too nice a day. He rounded one last patch of weeds a foot taller than he was and saw the artifact. Or what was left of it. The pieces of the packing crate were shattered, blackened, splintered, and tossed all over. So was the artifact. There was a large scorched area, blackened and buckled pavement with tendrils of smoke still rising from it. A layer of debris had been tossed around the area for 20 or 30 feet in every direction. And that was it. Miller felt his legs give way, and he knelt at what seemed to be the epicenter of the blast. A few pieces of something glittered at him through the dirt and scorched pavement. He poked at one, about the size of a kid's marble. It ran through the color spectrum, and he picked it up. His hand seemed to freeze and then feel heavy, but nothing like what he had experienced in the volcano. Just a tiny twitch, less noticeable than a mosquito bite, but it had to be a piece of the artifact. All that was left were a few fragments like this one. Miller stood wearily and put the fragment in his pocket, although he wasn't sure why. Souvenir of disaster, and worse to come. 72 hours. To do what? Go somewhere he wasn't sure of? Do something he hadn't been told? With what Cook had said were very low odds? No kidding, low odds. It was impossible. But he had to try. He started heavily toward his plane. Maybe if he pulled out the charts, he would recognize the numbers. 30-something, 100-something could only be a few places in the world. With luck, he could rule out most of them as being in mid-ocean. Whatever was left had to be someplace odd people could do their business without attracting attention. That ruled out a lot of the land surface, too, in his time. Thinking about it, he grew almost hopeful. Maybe he really could find this place. And if he could get there in time, who knew? Maybe he'd figure out the right thing to do, too. Cook's people might even send someone else to help. Why not? They could travel in time. He heard something then, off to the right, partly whipped away by the wind, but still clear enough to identify. It was a woman's scream. It came again, closer this time. And behind it came another sound, the sound of horses' hooves galloping, pursuing, and the shouts of the hunter. End of chapter.